This is Al Reynolds with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated April 12th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's top story, debt burden. Wakeboards far apart on school spending as past borrowing catches up to present. These stories are by Lee Weisbecker, and they're from Raleigh. Faced with a growing debt service and less money from the state to pay it down, Wake County commissioners are likely to go along with a fall vote on school bonds of just under $1 billion, less than half the amount the school board would like. Such is the scenario laid out by Joe Bryan, chairman of the Wake County Board of Commissioners, as he and his colleagues remain engaged in negotiations with school officials over projected needs and costs. Keith Sutton, chairman of the Wake County School Board, concedes that's about all the county can afford at this time. "We are working with the commissioners, and we know they feel the community would only be able to support so much," says Sutton. If approved, the bonds would add 4 to 5 cents to county property taxes that now stand at 0.534 cents per $100 of assessed property value. On a $200,000 home, a 4 cent hike would increase the annual tax bite by $80. School officials have offered several scenarios for buildings and renovations, with price tags ranging from as low as $609 million to as high as $2.3 billion. As for the high end, if it were Christmas, that might happen, says Brian, who adds that picking up a bill of that magnitude would require a property tax increase of 15 cents or more. And that's not going to happen, he says. He expects a fall 2013 bond referendum more in line with a $970 million package voters approved back in 2006. That funded numerous renovations and something on the order of 24 new schools, increasing the county's inventory of schools to 169. What doesn't seem to be in dispute is the matter of timing. "We want to have a vote in the fall of 2013, Brian says. That is the county commission's number one goal. It's a goal that will have to be accomplished in the face of a continued curtailment of financial support provided by the state to help counties pay down their debts. Locked in crisis mode, the General Assembly since 2009 has diverted $636 million that, during better times, would have flowed into the coffers of Wake and other North Carolina counties to help pay the debt service on money borrowed for school and other capital projects. That's not all that's been cut. Lottery proceeds flowing into the counties have been slashed from 40% to 22%. And a portion of state corporate tax collections, once earmarked to help the counties cover building costs, was sidetracked. Those two cuts translate into a total takeaway of $155 million a year. In 2011 and 12, Wake County received $10 million from the lottery, half of what it got in 2011, and a sum that translates into well less than one penny on the county tax rate. "When you look at the size of our school expenditures, it's a drop in the bucket," Tony Gurley, a county commissioner and former chairman of the board, says, of the state's contribution to debt service. The promise of the state lottery has not been fulfilled, is how Brian puts it. Statewide, though, the cuts are huge, says Todd McGee of the North Carolina Association of County Commissioners. "The amount of money we've been receiving has been reduced for 3 years in a row, and with the economy getting better, the counties had been hoping it would be returned." Under the McCrory administration's first 2-year state spending plan, those hopes have been dashed. The money is not being restored as Jones Street looks to build reserves. Wake County this year faces debt payments totaling $203.7 million. That debt load is projected to be $174.8 million in 2015. The large majority of that borrowing is for school needs. The Wake County Public School System was the nation's 14th fastest growing school district, population 200,000 plus, between 2006 and 2011. During that period, enrollment grew by 18.21%. with 169 schools and roughly 149,508 students, it's adding about 3,000 to its enrollment every year. Even though it's less than half the pre-Great Recession growth rate of 7,000 per year, the growth is still significant, and Brian and Gurley recognize that more schools are going to be in need. But they say the county has learned to live with less. The school system needs to do the same. The debate over funding comes at a time when the school board is racked with political divisions, pitting Democrats against Republicans, even though elections are billed as nonpartisan. Given the track record of the board, Gurley says he doubts voters are in the mood to pass a large issue. This next article is on the same subject of school debt. All eyes in Wake County schools bond debate are focused on a pair of bills in the General Assembly that would dramatically increase the power of county officials to ride herd over schools' growth. Not surprisingly, school board members are not impressed. The first and most significant of the two measures was introduced by State Senator Neil Hunt, a Wake County Republican. It would give county commissioners in the state's 100 counties the option of deciding if and how deeply they want to get involved in school construction issues. Those opting in could then take over such matters as land acquisition, construction management, repairs, and renovations, all of which now falls under the purview of school boards. Counties would also be given the green light to take actual ownership of school buildings and property. Introduced in mid-March, Hunt's bill was sent to the Senate's Education, Higher Education Committee, where it remains. Wake County Commissioner's Chairman Joe Bryan, currently locked in negotiations with the Wake School Board over growth needs, says he likes the Hunt approach. "I support it wholeheartedly," he says, while not handicapping its chances of making it through the legislature this session. To fellow Commissioner Tony Gurley, passage of the Hunt bill has become linked with current discussions over the need for another Wake County schools construction bond issue. In short, he doesn't believe voters will have an appetite at all for more bonds and higher taxes without the changes proposed in the Hunt bill taking place first. "This is going to have to end up with the county being in charge," says Gurley. Wake School Board Chairman Keith Sutton says, "No, we don't support this." Attempts to reach Hunt were not successful. Another bill in the General Assembly would take away the right of school boards to file legal action against counties in funding disputes. Instead, county commissioners would become the sole authority for determining whether their local schools have enough money both to operate and to build new facilities. Still on the front page, bottom of the fold, workplace deaths are down across North Carolina. This article is by Chris Bagley, and it's from Raleigh. North Carolina's job fatality numbers fell to their lowest level in 4 years in 2012 and were near their lowest level in more than a decade, an upside to the sluggish construction market and North Carolina's generational shift away from manufacturing. A total of 35 people were killed in job-related incidents last year, the lowest annual total in a decade, except for 2009, when 34 people lost their lives, according to a Triangle Business Journal and analysis of data from the North Carolina Department of Labor. Annual death tolls were in the 80s and 90s during the housing boom, with construction often accounting for half. Workers are most frequently killed in falls from heights or when struck by heavy objects, situations that are relatively common in construction. In a November 20th incident in Wake County, a water and sewer construction worker was killed when a trench caved in around him. Kevin Beauregard, Assistant Deputy Commissioner of Labor, says the decade-long decline parallels a North Carolina Department of Labor program that engages with construction companies in urban counties and in counties with multiple fatalities. The goal is to make construction employers more aware of regulations and hazards alike. "To some degree, they've been successful in doing that," says Tom Davis, a Poynter Sproul partner in Raleigh who handles commercial litigation and safety compliance. The State Department of Labor's Raleigh region, which covers 26 eastern North Carolina counties, accounted for more than half of the 53 statewide deaths in 2011. State officials attributed that in part to the triangle's relatively busy construction industry. But fatality numbers fell both locally and statewide last year. Those numbers parallel data showing workplace injury rates falling in recent years, both in North Carolina and nationally. The U.S. Labor Department counted 908,000 occupational injuries and illnesses that caused employees to miss work in 2011, the latest year for which data are available. That annual count fell steadily from 1.32 million in 2003. In North Carolina, Davis says he also credits broader availability of Spanish language safety guidelines with helping limit fatalities and serious injuries among construction workers. And general contractors have become more aggressive about requiring their subcontractors to sign on to safety policies, says Davis. It's also been a method, frankly, to downstream liability, he replies. Beauregard and several attorneys say larger companies, whether in construction or other industries, tend to have human resources personnel who focus specifically on safety more often than do smaller companies. And the tepid construction market of the last few years has been kinder to subcontractors with strong safety records, says John Honeycutt, a litigator with Yates McClam in Raleigh. The bigger the organization it is, the more likely is that there will be a safety department, Honeycutt says. Even so, Davis says large and diverse companies in the modern economy often require their employees to handle more tasks than employers did 20 and 30 years ago. Safety and safety training sometimes fall by the wayside in the new environment, he says. Next up, moving inside the front page, $35 million loan due on Crabtree Hotel. By Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. Although one of the Triangle's most iconic hotels, the Marriott Raleigh Crabtree Valley, continues to enjoy steady bookings, trouble lurks beneath the surface. A $35 million loan taken out by the owners of the 375-room hotel property on Glenwood Avenue came due in March, according to sources with Trepp LLC, a commercial mortgage data provider. Cornerstone Real Estate Advisors of Connecticut is the current owner of the property, which is up to date on mortgage payments. Joe Fuller, who had been with the hotel for 10 years, left his job as general manager in February for another post at a Marriott hotel in Detroit. And a search for a buyer for the Crabtree Hotel, which fetched $45 million 5 years ago, has come up empty. At the time Cornerstone bought the Crabtree Marriott in 2007, it had the property appraised at $50 million, according to Trepp. A Wake County tax appraisal on the property in 2008 valued it at only $37 million. I think the hotel has been doing pretty well, says Dennis Edwards, president and CEO of the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau. But I had heard that it's up for sale, and I've not heard of anyone that is currently hot on the trail to buy it. Data from Trepp show that the Crabtree Marriott's room occupancy levels declined from 71% in 2008 to 57% in the first 6 months of 2009. But it subsequently rebounded with an occupancy level of 73% reported in September. That's better than the Triangle average in 2012, according to a Smith Travel Research report, which showed the market had an average hotel occupancy rate of 60.5% for the year. Joe McBride, a research analyst for Trepp, says lodging properties across the country have taken more of a beating from the economic recession than most other commercial property sectors, probably because they are more cyclical than other types of properties. When the economy goes, companies stop having junkets and people stop traveling as much, says McBride. At least five other major Marriott-branded hotels across the country are facing foreclosure or auction, according to news reports, including Marriott properties in Atlanta, Memphis, Richmond, San Antonio, and Oklahoma City. McBride says that because mortgage payments on the Crabtree Marriott are current, the property is not at risk of foreclosure, unless the owners refuse to negotiate with the lenders to find a buyer or to refinance the $35 million balance on the loan. Patrick Collins, a spokesman for Cornerstone, says company executives would have no comment about the Raleigh property. Continuing on, backers with pedigrees give a drug firm some heft. This article is by Lauren K. Onisorge and is from Durham. Fresh off an $11 million private equity investment round, Durham startup Novan Therapeutics has two big pluses pushing it towards the next phase in clinical testing for its acne treatment, cash and experience. The company, which came out of discoveries made at UNC Chapel Hill in 2008, has attracted the attention of some big triangle players, namely industry veteran Bob Ingram and Cree Incorporated co-founder Neil Hunter. And it's ready, says CEO and founding scientist Nate Stasko, to take the next step, Phase 2 human trials. We're fueled by passion, he says. Everything we do stems from nitric oxide. Don't confuse the platform compound with nitrous oxide, that loopy laughing gas. Nitric oxide, long studied as a potential cancer-fighting agent, among other applications, is something the body already uses to fight infection. Your body is making nitric oxide every second, every day, Stasko explains. But it's not making enough of it to do what researchers think it's capable of. The substance is highly reactive, and as a gas, it's impossible to chemically store. So, scientists have had trouble harnessing its potential. Until now. We discovered we could stably store nitric oxide, he says. And that's important, because Novan's leader say they have discovered ways to store enough of it to make a difference. They say they also figured out how to target it towards drug delivery, enabling control over the compound. Still, while Stasko and team knew they had a medical compound, they weren't sure where to focus their efforts. On cancer? On cardiology? Well, we knew nitric oxide is antimicrobial, Stasko says, adding that $7.5 million in government grants supported efforts to develop treatments for wounds, but Stasko and team wanted more. And they soon discovered something else about their compound. That nitric oxide could help control sebum, oils produced by the skin. That pointed them to acne. Roche developed Accutane is a comparable acne medicine, Stasko says, in that it too produces sebum. And it skyrocketed to $800 million in sales in the 1990s, but as an oral drug, it had undesirable side effects. What Novan is shooting for is a nitric oxide-based topical treatment for acne with few side effects. And, unlike with antibiotics, the chance of resistance is minimal. After all, the human body has been battling bacteria with nitric oxide for thousands of years and has yet to encounter resistance. To date, Novan has raised more than $20 million from private equity investors. No small reason for that is the pedigree of its board, including Hunter, the chairman. Novan technology can impact so many different therapeutic areas, says Hunter, who adds that he was looking for a new challenge when he heard the Novan pitch. He says it's not typical for a company to get so much funding without venture capital, but it's the way he likes to launch companies. I think VCs or venture capitalists, they're not necessarily looking for quick exits, but everyone is going to look at that. What is the exit, he says. The gestation period needs to be a little longer for Novan, and that's something the company's investors understand. Ingram, former chairman and CEO of GlaxoSmithKline and a Novan board member, was pulled into the fold by Hunter. He says the fact that the company has been able to attract so much private capital is a credit to the quality of their science. When I saw the dramatic impact it had, particularly as a dermatology application on conditions like acne, I was very impressed, says Ingram. Also on the board are John Palmore, Chief Technology Officer of Cree, Mark Schoenfisch, a Novan co-founder and professor of chemistry at UNC Chapel Hill, and Stasko. New treatment options in acne would be welcome, wrote pediatric dermatologist Dr. Craig Burkhart, assistant professor at UNC Chapel Hill. Next up, miracle pill. With its oral medication approved, Biogen IDEC could rule the MS market. This article is by Lauren K. Onsorge, and it's from the Research Triangle Park. Inside the capsules, Biogen IDEC hopes multiple sclerosis patients will find a miracle, a drug with a higher efficacy rate than the two pills that came before it and allow them to avoid painful injections. Investors have equally high hopes that Tecfidera, approved in March by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, will be a major boost for a company that just 8 years ago had to deal with safety concerns about an existing MS injectable drug, Tysabri. Research Triangle Park has a stake, too, in that Tecfidera could be manufactured at a plant that Biogen is leasing with an option to buy from Japanese firm Eisai, meaning more jobs and more activity at the already busy campus. It's a big change from a few years ago. This was one of the least favorite names in the biotech sector back then, notes Cowen analyst Eric Schmidt, referring to February 2005. That's when Biogen withdrew Tysabri from the U.S. market after just 3 months. Three patients who were on Tysabri developed a rare brain disease, and two of them died. After the drug was reintroduced in 2006 with tighter FDA regulations, damage had been done. Now Biogen is back with Tecfidera. Tecfidera, by all accounts, has been pushing Biogen IDEC's stock up ever since investors caught a glimpse of the clinical profile of the drug 2 years ago. This drug could have best-in-class properties, Schmidt says. I believe it is the best agent for the disease in terms of its overall safety, efficacy, and convenience profile, and hopes are pretty high. The stock price has gone up threefold since it became known Tecfidera looked this good. And Biogen's hopes have been on the rise, too, notes Kate Dawson, global lead on the Tecfidera clinical development program for the company. We even, internally, kind of underestimated the impact this drug would have on patients, she says, but that was before the clinical trial data came back. Her team will continue testing the drug for the next 5 years because it's always good to get as much data as you can, but hopes are high. It's very exciting, says Richard Francis, Senior Vice President of U.S. Commercial Operations for Biogen. We're really proud to be able to bring something as innovative as Tecfidera to market. Research Triangle Park has its own reason to hope. A December partnership with Japanese firm Eisai gives Biogen access to part of Eisai's RTP campus, including an oral solid dose facility capable of manufacturing Tecfidera. Currently, the drug, which started shipping over Easter weekend, is being manufactured outside the company, though Biogen offers no details. Biogen spokesman Mike McBrearty, however, does say that Biogen is mulling the possibility of utilizing the Eisai facility, which includes an option to purchase. He confirms Biogen has made investments in the facility, though he won't be specific. Schmidt suspects the pills are being manufactured in Europe, and he doubts that will change due to tax incentives regarding patents. If you manufacture the drug outside the U.S., it provides for a lower tax rate, and that might be important for what could be a blockbuster drug like Tecfidera, he says. Biogen officials say it will likely take several months to reach a decision about whether to manufacture Tecfidera in the park, and execs won't comment on how that decision would impact Biogen's option to purchase the Eisai OSD facility. Biogen is based in Weston, Massachusetts. The company employs 1,075 people at its Research Triangle Park manufacturing facility. MS drugs Tysabri and Avonex are manufactured also in the park. Continuing on, PowerSecure's Growth Path by Chris Bagley. This article is from Wake Forest. Two acquisitions by PowerSecure International Incorporated reflect growing investment in energy efficiency and alternative energy sources, people are in the sector are saying. A solar business, which PowerSecure acquired from Morrisville's Southern Energy Management in June, builds solar farms for utilities and rooftop solar arrays for large commercial customers. The other new business line focuses on improving the energy efficiency of clients' buildings. PowerSecure acquired it in early March from a Charlotte area company. The acquisitions and organic growth together have increased the company's headcount to about 700 from 540 in January 2012. Its annual revenue grew to $162 million last year, nearly double the $85 million it posted in 2009. Company executives and outside analysts say the acquisitions make sense given the steadily growing use of energy alternatives. It shows the convergence of a lot of these things, says Steve Calland, executive director of the North Carolina Solar Center at NC State University. PowerSecure CEO Sidney Hinton says that's all the more true at the company level. PowerSecure was already focused on helping clients optimize energy use through two of its three business lines. Its largest line, with $76 million in revenue in 2012, provides electrical generators and distribution to factories and corporate campuses as a reliable and less expensive alternative to the outside power grid. The new solar business is being integrated with that line. It's a logical match because of the growing number of corporate campuses in installing solar panels, analysts say. Such panels' output blips every time a cloud passes in front of the sun, and PowerSecure's generating systems are designed to keep energy supply steady through such blips from the grid. A second business line, PowerSecure's smallest, with $25 million in annual revenue, produces light-emitting diodes, an energy-efficient alternative to incandescent lighting for uses including refrigerated cabinets and grocery stores. The energy services business represents a new sales channel for those lights, Hinton says. It's a wonderful time to be in the energy efficiency market, he says. Known in the industry as ESCOs, energy service companies, such businesses have historically focused on improving the efficiency of university and government buildings, though interest from the private sector is growing. Most clients pay ESCOs for the upgrades in installments, like a buyer paying off the mortgage of a seller-financed house. Each periodic payment is designed to be roughly equal to the money saved on energy during that period. PowerSecure now acts as a contractor for relatively large ESCOs that serve military bases and government agencies. Large players in the business include the HVAC company Trane and a division of the German industrial giant Siemens. ESCOs have particularly good potential to grow in the private sector, says Ralph Thompson, co-chairman of the Energy Services Coalition's North Carolina chapter and CEO of Holcein Energy in Raleigh. But he says the trick will be helping companies cover the upfront cost. A lot of companies are looking to save money on energy, but they need the capital to do it, says Thompson. Next up, Governor McCrory's partnership idea is not new. This article is by Amanda Hoyle and is from Raleigh. Governor Pat McCrory caused quite a stir among those in the state's economic development community when he announced on April 8th a plan to overhaul the North Carolina Department of Commerce and transfer most of its duties to a public-private partnership under the name Partnership for Prosperity. The private nonprofit organization, he said, would have a board of directors that would be headed by the governor, but the agency would be led by a chief executive officer. A search for a CEO has already begun. Its functions would include small business development, entrepreneurship, international investment and imports and exports, along with travel and tourism. Left unchanged would be the Employment Security Division that was folded into the Commerce Department in 2011. A partnership similar to McCrory's idea was put in place in Virginia in 1995. Virginia, like North Carolina, regularly ranks among the 10 most successful states in recruitment of big capital investment projects, according to Site Selection magazine. In 2012, Virginia ranked as number 9 in Site Selection's Governor's Cup contest, with 199 economic development projects, choosing the Commonwealth over competitor states in 2011. North Carolina bested Virginia with a number 7 ranking in the Governor's Cup contest, with 280 projects. Texas, Ohio, and Pennsylvania led the list. A 2011 report from Good Jobs First, a nonprofit taxpayer watchdog group, noted that 7 states currently allow private entities to control their business recruitment functions: Virginia, Florida, Indiana, Michigan, Rhode Island, Utah, and Wyoming. The report warned that some privatized economic development groups have become embroiled in controversies involving allegations of misuse of taxpayer money, excessive executive bonuses, and questionable subsidy deals. State Representative Tom Murray, a Wake County Republican, supports McCrory's plan. "Our current approach to economic development often duplicates efforts, wastes state resources, and lacks clear focus," Murray says. Steve Brantley, Economic Development Director for Orange County, says he hopes that the new entity would keep many of the staffers who have developed a knowledge of the state's available sites and buildings. Brantley says, "If everything is completely new, everyone is having to develop new relationships and form new networks. There are good people, and there are a lot of institutional knowledge, and it is talent that serves this state." This week's question and answer column under the commercial and residential real estate subject by Amanda Jones Hoyle features investors titled Steve Brown on the new North Carolina lien law. On April 1st, a new construction lien law for North Carolina went into effect. Triangle Business Journal talked with Steve Brown, vice president and title attorney with Investors Title Insurance Company in Chapel Hill, about the change. Question: why was this new legislation needed? Who was this law designed to protect, and why? Mr. Brown's answer: the new legislation was designed to protect real estate purchasers, lenders, and their insurers from undiscoverable lien claims, and to provide those who build or supply materials to a project a better mechanism to ensure timely payment. Question: what is the biggest difference between the old lien law and the new lien law? Mr. Brown's answer: under the old lien law, a potential lien claimant could wait as long as 120 days after the completion of work before filing a claim of lien at the courthouse. Generally, under the new legislation, an owner making improvements of greater than $30,000 to a property must appoint a private lien agent prior to beginning construction. Question: what would be the role of the lien agent? Mr. Brown's answer: the lien agent collects the notices filed by the potential lien claimants and reports them to the closing attorney for a purchaser or lender so that any potential lien can be accounted for at the real estate or loan closing. The lien agent is paid by the owner of the property based upon the fees mandated by the legislation: $25 per one- or two-family residential property and $50 per any other type of property. Moving on through to Jason DeBruin's column about healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. This article is entitled "Healthcare Coverage Cost Rises Slow Down a Bit." From Raleigh: health insurance premiums increased by an average of 2.6% in North Carolina in the past year. While that still means more money coming out of the employees' pockets, it's the smallest single-year increase in recent memory. Year over year, premium increases have been at least 4.8% and as much as 6.8% every year since 2007 in North Carolina, according to data compiled by CAI, a human resource management firm in Raleigh, and published in the annual North Carolina Healthcare Benefits and Cost Survey. It's still an increase, but a much more modest increase from what we have seen, says Molly Hedgman, CAI's Director of Human Resource Services. Various reasons for the slowed increases are positive for employees. More companies are implementing wellness programs, and there is a more sophisticated approach toward health and well-being in the workplace that is paying dividends. There's another reason as well. Data show that employees are choosing to move into high-deductible plans to decrease their premiums or at least keep them the same. It's somewhat akin to potato chip makers reducing the chip count per bag but keeping the price the same. That tracks with national trends. Results of a survey published in Health Affairs show that the number of people enrolled in high-deductible health plans increased from 8% of the total in 2009 to 19% in 2012. A Common Fund study shows that the average per-person deductible has increased by 117% since 2003, from $518 per person on average that year to $1,123 on average per person in 2011. Those who track the health insurance industry all make roughly the same point, namely that companies are growing more comfortable with shifting health insurance costs to employees. In a final positive for employees seeking health insurance, Hedgman points to data that show more companies are offering consumer-driven health plans. Nearly 72% of employers still offer only traditional plans, but that's down nearly 14 percentage points from 2008, with more companies now offering several plans from which employees can choose. I personally am a fan of that because it gives the employee a chance to choose what plan is best for them, Hedgman says. Data for the CAI survey were collected from 677 companies in North Carolina, 52% of which are in the Research Triangle region, and nearly all respondents have fewer than 1,000 employees. This week's column on Infotech, Biotechnology, and Entrepreneurism by Lauren K. Ansorge leads off with Bacteria and Urea in Mix Causes Bricks to Grow, from the Research Triangle Park. Architect-turned-scientist Ginger Dozier's obsession with seashells could change the way structures are built. That's the dream, at least. Dozier hopes her Research Triangle Park startup, BioMason, will not only make construction more sustainable, but also lead to changes in the way materials are made. After all, BioMason makes bricks in a very different way. The company grows them much the way mollusks grow into their shell. Her bricks, she says, are similar in function to traditional bricks, though vastly different in the way they came to be. So why not stick with tradition? Because of carbon footprint concerns, she says, adding that traditional bricks are fired using high heat, which creates all manner of environmental issues. More than 1.2 trillion bricks are produced each year globally, she says, adding that the production creates about 800 million tons of carbon dioxide. To express that number, that's more than all the airplanes in the world combined produce each year, she says, adding that her process is done at ambient temperatures. Her sustainability hopes are dependent, however, on a technology that can take 5 days to produce a brick similar to the one that traditionally can be baked and cooled in about 2 days. It's also a technology that creates its own havoc in the form of ammonia. Dozier, who just left a job teaching architecture in the United Arab Emirates, moved to RTP to be closer to researchers here and at NC State University, where she taught for 2 years previously. North Carolina also has a significant swine population, she notes, and there's a possibility that pig urine could become part of her brick-making process. RTP, specifically within the incubator space of First Flight Ventures, was a logical choice for her to begin work on her method. That method begins with an aggregate sand clay soil that is mixed with bacteria. Urea, a substance found in urine, then is mixed in to produce an enzyme that causes the pH levels to increase around the bacteria. The materials are placed in a mold, and over 5 days, calcium forms crystals around the bacteria, hardening the brick. It's like growing cement, she says. But she quickly discovered a problem. Part of the bacteria process involves the organisms breaking down the urea into ammonia and carbon dioxide. While the carbon dioxide is used in the crystallization process, the ammonia is not, and it can pollute the air. To solve the problem, Dozier enclosed the mold, capturing the ammonia. In the future, she may be able to resell that material, she says. She's currently raising money with a goal of having $2.5 million over the next 2 years to jumpstart production. John Sanders, president of the National Brick Research Center in Clemson, South Carolina, would not comment on the new method for making bricks. Biomass Technology received a Better Brick Award from Metropolis Magazine, and thus far, with her own funds and grants, Dozier is at about $50,000 in total seed financing. This week's spotlight is on performing arts. This week's article is Lights, Camera, Action, Tar Heel State in the Spotlight, by Dathan Kazuga, from Raleigh. The state of North Carolina has been gaining momentum in celluloid. Turn on the TV set or take the family out to the movies, and there's a good chance part of the show or commercial being viewed was either filmed, edited, or produced in the Tar Heel State. Take, for example, the post-apocalyptic NBC show Revolution. The show, which stars Billy Burke and Tracy Spyridakos, is shot in the Wilmington area, including on the campus of UNC Wilmington. There's also Iron Man 3, which will hit the big screen on May 3rd. Parts of this Marvel Comics adaptation starring Robert Downey Jr., Gwyneth Paltrow, and Don Cheadle was filmed at the offices of Epic Games and on the SAS campus, both in Cary. Locally, the Triangle has a handful of mid-sized film and sound studios, such as Trailblazer Studios in Raleigh. Trailblazer is ran by CEO Tom Wearing, who, with his wife, purchased the company in 2001. Over the years, we've developed into a TV and commercial production company, says Wearing. We delivered around 500 shows over the past 5 years. Trailblazer Studios has done shows for cable channels Discovery, TLC, DIY, HDTV, and National Geographic. Wearing talks about the working relationship the studio has with Chapel Hill's Figure Eight Films. The film studio, which is run by President Bill Hayes, brought TV viewers a little closer to the Goslin family, better known to the world as John and Kate Plus Eight. With Figure Eight, we're also producing a show called Salvage Dogs, Wearing says. The show follows a Roanoke, Virginia architectural salvage operation and airs on the DIY network. As a facility, we're a resource for the film industry, says Trailblazer's executive producer of music and sound, Eric Johnson. Another local film studio is Firehorse Films, Incorporated in Raleigh. One of the studio's most recent projects was Thankfully Local with Chef Chuck, a project that follows host Chuck Hayworth around the state preparing healthy meals. Firehorse Films is the brainchild of executive producer Jean-Paul Dame, who got his start in television in the early 1980s working on programs in Southern California. After serving in the Army for 7 years and being involved in the production of the Army's Be All You Can Be ad campaign, Dame did a few other jobs before he wound up in Raleigh in 1995. When I first opened Firehorse Films in 2006, my goal was to bring a broadcast approach to all my projects, says Dame. We have 3 employees at the company, and I utilize a wide variety of freelancers to fill out any particular projects. Currently, Dame has 12 people on staff just to help put together Thankfully Local. Besides Thankfully Local, Firehorse is working on a show entitled Golfing Interest with Augustus Cho. Dame is also experienced in making political commercials over the past 12 years, creating sports for the likes of U.S. Creating spots for the like of U.S. Senator Richard Burr, North Carolina House Speaker Tom Tillis, Agriculture Commissioner Steve Troxler, and Labor Commissioner Cherry Berry, to name a few. Over the past year, I have noticed more and more television programming coming out of North Carolina, says Dames. I believe it has to do with the quality of talent in terms of producers and directors that have made North Carolina their home, like I have. According to the North Carolina Film Office, 26 movies or TV series have wrapped up production over the past 12 months in the state, including the recent seasons of the aforementioned Revolution and Homeland, which features actors Claire Danes, Damian Lewis, and Mandy Patinkin, thank you. But out of those 26, not a single one was filmed in Raleigh. Dathan Kazuk interviewed Mr. John Paul Dames at his Raleigh studio, and here is the result. Firehorse Films has been around since 2006, but I know you did a lot of work in the industry before moving to Raleigh. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Mr. Dame replies, over the years I've worked with all the major networks as a field producer or shooter. ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox, and ESPN, to cover a few of the alphabet channels. Programs that I've shot for include Nightly News, Inside Edition, Southern Living presents Trackside and NASCAR Now. One of my career highlights was having the opportunity to film the great white sharks that breach out of the waters in South Africa. Do you have any advice for someone looking to get their own TV show? Any pros and cons you can give? Mr. Dame replies, "Don't go into the business. I get idea submissions all the time from individuals who have a great idea for a TV show, and I can help them get their pilot or proof of concept done. I really don't believe people have the faintest idea of what it takes to, 1, come up with a show idea and flesh it out, 2, how much time and money it takes to make a show. Let's take Thankfully Local as an example. It was March 2012 when I was approached to make the show pilot. It took us 6 weeks to film and post the pilot. MAV TV ordered 5 more episodes after watching the show, but they don't air the shows until October 2012. And production didn't start until August. Oh, and you don't get paid from the network until you deliver the shows. So, someone has to float the show budget. And lastly, what projects is Firehorse Films working on at this point in time? Mr. Dame replies, right now, Firehorse Films has several TV shows in production, which is a maddening process. We are exploring taking our Thankfully Local with Chef Chuck to a daily cooking show this fall. We have Golfing Interests with Augustus Cho. This is a show on people of interest who have an interest in golf. We have a show that stars me and my brother Billy, America's Oddities, which is a travelogue show about two stupid brothers who travel America and explore its grand oddities. This show came about as our own home vacation movie, just done to my own level of production. Then there's also Behind the Artist, which is a behind-the-scenes show on a show about what goes on behind the scenes. So you'll see the producers, cameras, and crew. This week's Washington Watch is by Mr. Kent Hoover, who is the chief of Triangle Business Journal's Washington Bureau. Banks making more loans. Community banks that received cheap capital from the federal government increased their lending to small businesses by $1.5 billion in the fourth quarter of 2012. That's the second highest quarterly increase in the history of the Small Business Lending Fund. Congress created this program in 2010 to stimulate small business lending by providing capital to community banks and community development loan funds. The SBLF capital, which was distributed in 2011, came with incentives to use it for small business loans. Still, the program isn't coming close to its potential. Only $4 billion out of a potential $30 billion capital has been provided to lenders. But the latest numbers do show the program is working, even if only 332 community banks and community development funds got the money. And some use fund to exit TARP. For many banks, the Small Business Lending Fund has been nothing more than a way to get out of the troubled asset relief program. That's the conclusion of the federal government's Special Inspector General for the TARP program, Christy Romero, who analyzed how the community banks used SBLF capital. The program was created by Congress to increase lending to small businesses, but $2.7 billion out of SBLF's $4 billion in capital went to 137 banks that were TARP recipients. These banks used $2.1 billion of their SBLF capital to pay back their TARP debts so they could escape the program's stigma and restrictions, such as caps on executive compensation. And finally, health care reform is a top issue. Health care reform tops economic uncertainty as the biggest concern for small businesses, according to a survey conducted for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. More than 75% of the 1,332 small business owners and executives surveyed by Harris Interactive said health care reform will make insurance coverage for their employees more expensive. This week's Small Business Profile is on ESP Surgex. It's by Lauren Onisorge. Stopping the zaps from surges is a mission of a $40 million company. Your electronics faced constant assault. Really? That's according to ESP Surgex CEO Steve Galloway, and he's hardly talking about lightning, which only accounts for about 5% of surge events that can fry your computer. 85% of the issue is what happens in your building, he says, particularly those costly HVAC systems. See surge events, those spikes in electric current that smack into your home theater system, show no mercy. And those cheap white surge protectors? Well, they don't last long, says Galloway, explaining that while the little green light might still work, if it's been around a while, chances are the surge protection has been crystallized. Rob Dolly, an NC State University grad and engineer at the company, says that even if your equipment doesn't fry, it's highly possible that without protection, electronics simply won't last their intended shelf life, a costly error depending on how much your electronic investment totals. While a $5 power strip might be all you need for a $50 radio, when larger equipment is at play, it's not worth the risk, he says. How much larger? Hubble Telescope larger. Dallas Cowboys Stadium larger. That's why SurgeX equipment is at play in both of those arenas, protecting hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment by eliminating surge, not just suppressing it like a typical strip. And if the surge is extended, this system will shut down your electronics instead of letting them fry. It's high-end, he says, adding that his technology has a price tag that reflects that quality. And from when he's arrived in 2009, the company has done a complete 180-degree turn. I put together a plan, he says. Since 1985, the company had focused on technology for imaging and printing devices. Galloway wanted more. You start looking at the growth and where the technology is going, he says of his thought process. Then, Electronic Systems Protection Incorporated, ESP, focused on offices so that office equipment such as photocopiers could function properly and efficiently. ESP technology reduced ground noise and provided cleaner power. But Galloway saw that those same technologies could be applied to other markets. That's when he went shopping. ESP acquired SurgeX in 2010 to expand into new vertical markets, specifically the audio-video market, and that's when things started to snowball. We've doubled our headcount over the past 3 years, he says. We hope to triple it over the next 2 to 3 years. Currently, 135 people work at the Knightdale facility, and a series of new deals could help ESP SurgeX in that pursuit. He can talk about one of the deals now, with PC maker Dell, which is utilizing ESP SurgeX technology in a new server line. While he won't talk financials, he does say that the deal is what led the company to renovate a building for $2.5 million in Knightdale to serve as its new headquarters. The company moved into the new facility in January, a facility that has plenty of room to expand. Think room for 300 in the manufacturing facility and 60 in the management office. The new manufacturing facility can pump out 25,000 products per shift a month thanks to new equipment, and thanks to the company's own products, production is managed even more efficiently. Engineer Mike Darlington points to a server rack full of ESP SurgeX branded equipment vital in detecting and managing issues. The equipment can control everything from power supply to security cameras and can alert administrators via mobile phone to problems. It's pretty slick, he says. And it's made in the Knightdale facility. If Galloway has his way, that's where the majority will always be made. I've had a chance to move that production line to China, he says, pointing towards two men fitting plastic cases over plastic wired boards. But I don't want to do that. Instead, he says he wants to invest more in the local facility, and if other deals line up after Dell, he thinks it's in the cards. This week's column from the editor, the editor's notebook, is from Sugata Mukherjee, who is the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. And this week's column is entitled, New Commerce Could Work, But. It has been almost a month since MetLife announced it will locate operations in both Charlotte and Cary that could add 2,600 jobs in the state. So we asked the North Carolina Commerce Department to let us look at the recruitment file. That's allowed under the public records law. That was on March 15th. So far, nothing. No word, no updates, no communication. Perhaps the easy answer to this deafening quietness can be attributed to government efficiency. Maybe that's one of the reasons Governor Pat McCrory made the announcement this week that the state's economic development and incentives responsibility will fall under a newly created public-private partnership that will have its own CEO. Since taking office, McCrory has talked about the need for state government to offer better service that meets the needs of North Carolina residents. We all welcome that. And details of this massive overhaul of the Commerce Department will emerge eventually, but after talking to a few business executives around town, they want to see McCrory and Sharon Decker, the Commerce Secretary, focused on a few key points. 1. Plan for existing industry. The new partnership must have an equally robust incentive plan for companies that already have established their base in the Tar Heel State and have created numerous jobs over the past decade. While there are some tax benefits available to these companies, when they expand, most small businesses are left out of the conversation. 2. Help with global markets. Companies are always looking for new markets. Most small and mid-sized businesses are wary of doing business in new markets and countries since they know very little when it comes to consumer behavior, culture, and competition. This new partnership can have a division that caters only to small, medium, and large businesses with global connections. 3. Access. Businesses need access to data, resources, tools, and executives at all times. They want this new partnership to develop an initiative beyond populating the Commerce Department website. And 4. Diversity. Did I hear from at least two business owners in town that they are looking forward to seeing who the folks are who will make up the private part of this partnership? Interestingly, they worry whether these people will have similar ideological viewpoints or rather offer diversity in their thinking. As they say, the devil is in the details. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at trianglereadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.